What are some of the ways that you've learned to sit with not knowing? If in doubt, don't. Okay. Patience. Breathing. Oh my God. We're going to talk a lot about breathing when we talk about calm coming up. To know that the universe is trustable, that the universe will support you. Like, I'm a huge fan of the book, The Alchemist. Yeah. And there's something really great in there where he writes, when you're on the right path, the universe will conspire to help you. And I really believe that's true. Unfortunately, I think that path is paved with uncertainty. And so I think the quote, which is not as nice a way of saying it and not as poetic as he writes, is if you're willing to be uncertain and hold that space, good things will come of that. You'll often get to a place of clarity. And then how about this idea of trusting faith? We go back to kind of the spirituality. I couldn't find a good definition of faith. So what did I do? I wrote one. So here's how I define faith. Faith is a place of mystery where we find the courage to believe in what we cannot see and the strength to let go of our fear of uncertainty. And I think there are a lot of people of very deep faith. They're not religious people. And I think there are many, many religious people who are not people of faith at all. I want to share this quote from Richard Rohr. Here's what he writes. Theologian Richard Rohr. My scientist friends have come up with things like principles of uncertainty and dark holes. They're willing to live inside imagined hypotheses and theories. But many religious folks insist on answers that are always true. We love closure, resolution, clarity, while thinking that we are people of faith. How very strange that the word faith has come to mean its exact opposite. I think one of the things that's really important to talk about when we talk about faith and intuition and spirituality and mystery, faith and reason are not natural opponents. It's our need for certainty that have pitted faith and reason against each other. And one of the greatest weapons that controls that debate in our culture is shame. I'm dismissed in many circles by academics because I even write about spirituality. And we have to get to, it goes back to the binary that we even talked about with victim and Viking. Like faith and reason is another false dichotomy. It's another false binary that we create out of the need for certainty. Because how uncertain of a world will it be? Or how uncertain will our lives be if we believe that faith and reason can coexist? And some things will be mysteries that we will not understand, and other things are worth a pursuit of understanding and explaining, but not everything. And so I think one of the things we see a lot, and it's deeply human, is that we had rather be miserable and certain than wholehearted and uncertain. Right? It feels like we're coming out of our skin. So men and women who are wholehearted have found a way to hold space for uncertainty. And I'm still working on it. I'm not great at it. And I usually don't know that that's what I'm up against until I see myself acting out, rushing to make a decision. Just get it done. Just choose something. Let's go. Let's go. Get her done. Sign her up. Say yes. Or I start pulling people. So the question I think for you on this guidepost would be, how do you know that you're in uncertainty? What do you do to protect yourself from the vulnerability of that uncertainty? And how do you get back in touch with your intuition? You know, when people ask, what does your gut say? A lot of us respond, I don't know. I haven't talked to her in years. You know, I have no idea what my gut says. How can you make space for hearing it? I think one of the ways we make space for our gut is silence, is really quiet and white space in our lives. How many of you very purposefully create white space in your lives? About half. I find myself pulling up to a red light, and I know that at a red light, I can answer 2 to 3 emails depending on the complexity of the email at a red light. there's really no white space, that everything is scheduled and every moment. I waited tables and bartended for 6 years through school and graduate school. And I swear that that's one of the reasons I have this problem, because, you know, when you, how many of you have waited tables or bartended? A lot, right? If you have time to lean, you have time to clean. Like, consolidate, get stuff done. You're going to go to the table, take 14 things. It's part of it. And I did that during a very formative time in my life. And so I think a lot of times I'll be walking through the house, like going upstairs, and I'll have 16 things. And she's like, that was dangerous, man. And I'm like, why make six trips when you make one? It's like, because like I said, it looks dangerous, dude. It's like, I got it. Yeah, so I think, so now my big habit is white space. I schedule white space. It's as non-negotiable as going to work. I have a shared calendar that people see, like my speaking agencies and my literary agencies. And they're like, hey, we need you to do this interview with this magazine. I'm like, you know, at 9 o'clock, I see you're open. I'm like, no, I've got that scheduled out for white space. Yeah, I know, but you can do that. I'm like, no, 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 that's not negotiable space. I get it. But yeah, can you do that? I'm like, no, I can't. I turned down last year 87%. They give me a chart. 87% of the speaking requests that I got. Because it would be very easy to slip into a space of going around the world talking about wholeheartedness and not living wholeheartedly, right? This is a lot easier than not checking my email at the red light. And so we have to decide, how do we put white space in and how do we protect it as if it mattered, because it matters. How do we put the white space in? Guidepost number 6. Cultivating creativity and letting go of comparison. Across the interviews with wholehearted men and women, creativity emerged as a hugely important pattern. These folks were engaged in a creative something. They were photographers. They drew pictures. They rebuilt engines. They cooked. They knitted, they sewed, they did, I mean, they, every single one of these men and women who I would describe as wholehearted, were engaged in some kind of creative outlet. They made music, they made movies on their computers, they were in a band, they played the flute. Creativity emerged as hugely important. And what was interesting is that the shame trigger and the vulnerability shield that emerged as a thing that keeps us away from being creative was comparison. So how many of you actively practice creativity? Maybe about half. Okay, the other half. You're going to have to find something. And I feel with you. Let me tell you, before this started, I was the person that if someone said, and a lot of my friends are very creative people, would say, hey, do you want to go scrapbook or do you want to go take this painting class? My response was always the same. That's really cute. And that's neato. And you go do your ART, but I have a J-O-B. So you go do your self-indulgent, flaky art bullshit. And I'll be working. I mean, that was my response. It wasn't just a no thank you. And I probably said no thank you. I don't think I actually said that out loud to anybody. But I certainly, what was going on inside of me was like, oh God, are you kidding? Take a look. We're grown-ups. We got shit to do. That was my response around creativity. Seriously. Right. And then I do this research, and here's what I learned. First of all, you know that whole thing, like, I'm not really a creative person? No such thing. We're all creative. Creativity is a function of being human. There are simply people who use their creativity and people who do not. And here is the really hard news. Unused creativity is not benign. It does not dissipate. It metastasizes. And unused creativity turns into rage, grief, shame, judgment. I mean, the reason why I would respond like, Jesus, are you kidding? A painting class? I'm running carpool for soccer. I got this. You know, no. Judgment. Because inside of all of us is creativity. And when we don't use it, I'm telling you, it does not go away. And one of the big reasons that we stop using creativity is comparison. And we can track that back. I mean, I think I've already shared with you that 85% of the men and women I've interviewed remember something so shaming that happened in school that it forever changed how they thought of themselves as learners. 50% of those people, the shaming experience was around creativity. They have art scars. And by art scars, they can point to a specific moment in time where they were laughed at or put down. And let me tell you, if you're thinking to yourself, well, you know, a lot of these people, the mean age for my research participant was 40. And if you're thinking, well, yeah, you know, schools used to be tough. A very good friend of mine, we go to church together, just told me he just pulled his daughter out of a very exclusive private school in Houston because the assignment was to draw flowers. And she's in first grade, drew some flowers. And the teacher walked by and said, I told you not to use these colors and they don't look anything like the flowers we're drawing, and ripped up her page in front of her. Yeah, this happens all the time. An interview that I did with someone who his entire aspiration was to go to Rice University. I'm pretty sure he had a perfect score on the SAT, 1600. No question he could have gotten into Rice, which, do y'all know Rice University, the Harvard of the South in Houston? Very excited. And then he got the application. And to this date, as we're speaking, this is still on the Rice application. There's a box, a big empty box. And it says, draw something that reflects your thinking about X. And he just broke down in tears and threw it away. And he went to a different college because when he was in elementary school, a teacher held up a drawing that he had drawn and said, it's a good thing you're, and said this lovingly, it's a good thing you're so darn smart, John, because this is pretty much the worst horse I've seen in 20 years. These things change people's lives. They really do. And so comparison is the issue. And we have very interesting data around kids and creativity. Around fourth or fifth grade, we see a tremendous drop in creativity in children. And they call it the creativity slump because it is when children, you know, kindergarten, I got a kindergartner, first grade, second grade, third grade. I can tell you because we have art walls in our house where we hang up all the kids' art. Draw a horse. Charlie will draw a blue polka dot horse that has six heads, right? And the teachers are like, this is the best horse ever. It's great. I come home, look at my horse, Mom. It's blue. It's got four heads. I love it. This happens. Kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, draw a horse. Kids start looking around, and man, Susie just whipped out a horse that looks like a horse. And John's horse looks like the front of like horse magazine. And all of a sudden, my blue polka dotted four-headed horse, I don't fit in anymore. I'm not good at this anymore. And then you have middle school, where my daughter started middle school with the aspirations of being an artist until about the middle of sixth grade, where she was told that's not her strength. She's not really a good artist. Yet middle school is where they start grading art and they start having advanced art. Let me tell you something. Let me just look carte blanche at anyone who's making any rules about art in the world. You have kids who want to take advanced art. They should be let into advanced art. You know, my daughter didn't want to be let into advanced art. She wasn't interested in it, but she just also wasn't interested in being told, you're not a very good artist. You're more of a crafter. You know, and I see people my age struggling with this all the time. Like, why do you think that we're afraid to contribute and be innovative and creative at work? When, you know, if you've got 85% of men and women and then 40% of that have art scars that they can point to that change how they feel about themselves in terms of being creative people. And people can't make the leap from that to the cover of Time magazine where it says innovation crisis in the U.S. You know, this is a really big deal. To create, to innovate, to share things that have never existed before. That's the definition of creativity. To make something that hasn't existed before. To do that is incredibly vulnerable. To share your work with other people, to share a photograph that you took with some friends and in this great. Incredibly vulnerable. But creativity is a deep, important part of the human spirit. And we have to find a way to do it. And I've got to tell you that when this emerged, I was like, oh my God, I've got to get creative. What am I going to do? And I was very intentional. Like, remember I had the syllabus with my therapist. I'm like, okay, cultivate creativity. So what I do for the very first creative effort is I go to a gourd painting class in Houston. Laura Lopez Cano is a Latina artist, and her gourds are in the Smithsonian. She paints these incredible, like, Virgins of Guadalupe on gourds. And she had a gourd painting class at a store in 19th Street in Houston. So my mom and Ellen and I go. And Ellen's almost finished with her gourd. My mom's painting away, and I am paralyzed. It's like me and the paintbrush, and I'm just locked in to the Smithsonian gourd that she brought as a sample. I'm like, I'm not ever going to get this gourd in the Smithsonian. And so what exactly is the point of drawing the gourd? And she goes by Lauda, and Lauda walks up and she goes, you have not been creative lately, have you? Big tears streaming down my face. You just need to pick up the brush and do it. I was like, a lot of middle-aged white women come to my classes. They have this same problem. I was like, you know, painting. And then I haven't stopped. It's like I'm obsessed now with creativity. Like, I took, you know, photography classes. I do all kinds of photography. I make movies all the time with photographs. I just can't imagine that I used to not do that. You know what? It's play. It's creativity. It's fun. It's making something. And I think doing it with our families, you know, we have family art projects now all the time. We are like the goofiest, wholehearted people you'll ever meet now, for sure. But we do those projects all the time. And it's been like, I think to myself, what if I wouldn't have known this when Ellen came home teary-eyed about her art experience? And my response would have been like, oh God, thank God that thing's over. Let's move on. Algebra. That's where the action is. You know, had I not known, you know, and had we not been able to look out for our kids and encouraging my husband to find something, you know, cause that's, I think sometimes that can be harder, right? We're going to launch into play and rest in the next session, which is going to require a lot of time to unpack. And I think maybe it'd be better if we stopped here. And then the next session went into play and rest, because there's going to be a lot to talk about there. All right, great.
Our program continues with Session 6, Guideposts 7 through 10, with Brené Brown.
The last thing we talked about was cultivating creativity and letting go of comparison. And we're going to move on to the next guidepost. Guidepost number 7, cultivating play and rest, letting go of exhaustion as a status symbol and productivity as self-worth. I know. We talked a little bit. I think I used this as an example when I first mentioned wholeheartedness and that there was a collection of choices. I think I also mentioned that when play emerged from the data, I couldn't even recognize it. I didn't even really know what they were talking about. I just said fooling around. Well, when I realized it was play and I got into the literature, the person whose work that I found that I absolutely fell in love with was Stuart Brown. And I want to tell you a little story about Stuart Brown because I feel like he's a kindred spirit for me. No relation, by the way, on the Brown thing. And here's why. Like, I was a shame researcher, or am a shame researcher, and now I really look at wholeheartedness and joy. And Stuart Brown started as a violence researcher, and now as a play researcher, which I just think is interesting. So here's the story. In the 1960s, at the University of Texas at Austin, Charles Whitman climbed to the top of the tower at UT and opened fire, and killed many students, faculty members, staff, wounded a lot more. And at the time, it was the largest mass killing in the United States. And the governor at the time was John Conley, the governor of Texas, and everyone was just devastated. And Conley said, we're going to figure out why this happened, and we're going to spare no expense. We've got to understand what's happening here. How did this happen? You know, it's weird to be telling the story because the context is so different today because these things happen, it seems like, all the time. I guess they don't, but it feels like it. It's not like we're devastated. We're devastated, but we're just conditioned in some way. Which is not the case when this happened. So he pulled together a, you know, just no mind of budget or anything, pulled together the most comprehensive team of researchers, psychologists, psychiatrists that he could put together in the state of Texas to put together a social history of Whitman, to study other violent offenders who were in prison at the time, to understand what happened. And Stuart Brown, who is an MD, was at Baylor Psychiatric at the time, and he was in charge of analyzing the data. And one of the things that was very interesting, so they put together a social history of Whitman, and they did all this other interviewing, compiled all this information, and one of the big fears about the study was that it was not going to be very conclusive simply because of the multidisciplinary nature of the team. You know, where there's psychiatrists and sociologists and psychologists and child development people. I mean, just all over criminologists. And how could they ever come up with anything together? The very first piece of data, very first pattern that emerged in the research, studying these violent offenders, studying Whitman, what they all shared in common was a very restricted history of play. Wow. That Whitman, for example, was not allowed to play. His father, he had a very controlling father, and he was not allowed to spend time, you know, unscheduled time, goofing off and playing with friends. And they found this to be a reoccurring theme through all of the data, which is how Stuart Brown became a play researcher. And if you look at some of the play research and some of the other research, from some of the other researchers, there's a great quote, and I can't think of the name of the guy who said it, but it's the opposite of play is not work. The opposite of play is depression. And so in Stuart Brown's book and in his work, rather than defining play, he talks about properties of play. How do we know something's play? What is play? And so I'll talk about a couple of the properties because I think they're very telling in terms of our vulnerability and our shame triggers. One of the first properties of play, according to Stuart Brown, is time spent without purpose, which we call an anxiety attack, right? So it's time spent without purpose. Another property of play is it's something you don't want to end. It's something that you want to extend. It's something that you wish would keep going. It's something where we lose track of time. And I think another very important property of play, and one reason why we don't do it as adults, is that you lose that hypersense of self-consciousness. You don't care about how you're being perceived. You lose yourself a little bit. So if you think about play as something, as time spent without purpose, something we don't want to end, something where we lose ourselves, we lose our sense of time, you know, the question becomes, as adults, how many of us engage in play? In real play. And you know, and for me, it was shocking. I was clear that I did not play at all because, I mean, just reading those properties made me itchy. I thought, oh my God. Because for me, again, and I've talked about this in many times, we just had a family ethic of work and get things done. So as I started to think about it, I started to think about what do I think of as play? The first thing that came to mind was my kids love to play Candyland. And so I think about me playing Candyland with my kids. Oh my God, that is not play for me. It's not. That's parenting for me. It's important. I love it. I do it. But I am keenly aware of how long I'm doing it. I am tracking my good parenting mileage. I want it to end. Before I get to the Valley of the Peppermint or whatever you go to. So I'm going to ask y'all not to engage in a collective sigh here. So I decided to go and develop a Venn diagram for play. This is very helpful. If there's any problem, I can solve it with a Venn diagram. And if you give me like matte pencils or something color coordinated, I can totally, world peace is at my fingertips. So here's what I did. We were on a car trip. So I had my journal with me and I asked Steve and Ellen and Charlie these questions. What do you love to do so much that you lose track of time? You look up and it's hours later. You don't feel self-conscious. You feel like you can be goofy and weird and do whatever you want. You don't want it to end. It doesn't have a purpose. And so we started listing things and listing and listing and listing. And Ellen gave me a list and Charlie gave me a list and Charlie took some off and added and Steve gave me a list. And then I came up with my list and I made this Venn diagram, our family play Venn diagram. It changed our lives. Because what I realized was that there were only three or four places where we overlapped. But that those three or four places, we were giving them no time and space. Like family vacation, Disney. As it turns out, that doesn't meet anyone's requirement for play. Not even my kids. Play for us, the things that we share in common, all four of us, swimming, hiking, Foursquare. Although I'm super competitive. I am a kick-ass Foursquare player. I just want to put it right out there and own my power here. Foursquare, movie night, summer vacation. What, you know, all my friends are like, what are you doing? Where are you going? We're like, we're going right down the road to a lake house for 10 days where we can swim, hike. We all love fishing. It just changed everything because it was so important. And then Steve and I have our own little what is play for both of us, because I think so often we're out of touch with what is play for us. You know, and one of the questions I get asked all the time, which I think Stuart Brown is just so brilliant around this. One of the other ways that he studied play is he worked with Jane Goodall. He studied play in animals. And so one of the questions that I'm always asked is competition play. Well, here's what's interesting about competition and play. Because, you know, a lot of parents look at me and say, we are super good at play. My daughter plays soccer, plays tennis, plays the cello, speaks Mandarin. And that's on Monday. Really, you think I'm kidding. Come hang out with me at my house for a little while. So is competition play? And here's what's interesting, what he says about how he addresses that question. He says, in the animal world, contest is always a part of play. Chasing each other, wrestling each other, contest is a part of play, but not competition. And that's very obvious for this reason, that animals will handicap themselves in a contest just to extend play. So let's say I'm a bear and you're a bear. And we're wrestling and I'm chasing you. And then I get on top of you and I pin you down like bears do. What I'm going to do is, it's not like that competition would be, okay, I win. And then I just walk back to my tree and that's it. But contest is I win, I jump off, I smack you a little bit and start running the other way. You know what I mean? Like they're handicapping themselves to extend play. And so when parents ask me this question, my answer is, competition is not play in terms of how we are structuring it today for the most part. Does that make sense? So play. So what are some of the things, you know, for me, reading is play. I mean, I really, when my kids were very young, I was very much like my mother. I could not get engrossed in a good book because the house could burn down. I'd be like, what's happening? I lose total track of time in books. It's incredible how far we've moved away from play. And I got to tell you that I think we cannot raise children who value play more than what they see us playing. If play is really important, then we have to be playing and we have to protect that time and value that time. Very difficult. Let's talk about rest. How many of you are tired? Honestly. Yeah. The CDC defines sleep debt as more than two consecutive nights with less than 7 hours of sleep. again, if you're listening to this at home, this is uncomfortable rumbling. How many of you are in sleep debt? Yeah, and how many of you are thinking, I'm not going to raise my hand because that's not actually what I need? Yeah. I'm really good to go on four. Right. We are a sleep-deprived culture. And what's really scary is if you start, when this emerged as an important guidepost and I started looking at the data, at the research coming out of the CDC and the sleep institutes and the sleep researchers, you know, sleep debt is highly, highly correlated with obesity, cancer, diabetes. It's to blame for I don't know that they can put their finger on it, but they attribute a lot of motor vehicle accidents to sleep debt. The worst advice that I've ever heard is that you can rest when you're done. And some people say you can rest when you're dead, which means you're really done. But you know, the whole idea that we can't, and we heard this when I asked earlier, an earlier session about shame triggers around lazy. The whole idea that we can rest when we're done. Here's the hard, hard news. We're never going to be done. The to-do list never ends. We can never check everything off and feel solid and great and be done and rest. You know, it is a very shame trigger area for us because I'm telling you, how many of you relate to the idea of lazy as a major shame gremlin? How many of y'all would have shame come up if someone described you as lazy? I mean, it is a big deal. And so this whole idea that we can sleep, that we can stop, that we can rest, that we can quit. We can say, we can look at a project and say, this is consuming my life. It was important. I wanted to do it. It is not working. I quit. I'm not doing it. I want to talk about some mythology behind rest. And I think a weird paradox in our culture. One of the big vibes that scares me the most right now as an adult, as a parent, as a partner, even as a professional, is this whole new vibe that we're living in of fun, fast, and easy. That everything has to be fun, fast, and easy. I just don't know very many people who have achieved or accomplished what they want to do who have not worked their asses off to do it. Help me understand this. At the same time, we're exhausted and depleted. We only put value on things that are fun, fast, and easy. Like, what are we doing with our time? If everything's fun, fast, and easy, and we're tired all the time, and we're not sleeping, and we're not resting, what are we doing? And I think, in my experience, again, from the research and also from my life, that things are hard and take a lot of time and require a lot of work and thought. And how I would answer that question that I posed is that we are racing to finish things out of scarcity. You have no idea how many people I talk to who say, well, you know, I follow your work and I love your work and I think I would be a great social worker, but I could never go back to graduate school. That'll take me 3 years and I'm 40. Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but like you're going to be 43 anyway. Like if you skip graduate school, you're not skipping 43. It's coming. You know, if we, for some reason in this culture of scarcity, we can't say, I really want to do this. When Chris Anderson, who curates TED, said, why shame? I said, because it was my one professional before I die goal that I would help start a national conversation about shame. I think it can change the world. And he said, wow, how long have you been standing in that line? And I said, 13 years. Like this just didn't happen yesterday. We forget the value of long, hard, pulsed out over time work. And the only reason that poses a problem is if we buy into the idea that we can't rest until we're done. Then it's a problem. Then we're really tired at the end of 13 years. But I would also argue that the end of 13 years, our work product is pretty crappy because we developed most of it while we were exhausted. Like, it's this very weird space and idea of saying, this is something I want to work toward for the next couple of years. And while I'm doing it, I'm going to rest and I'm going to play and I'm going to create and I'm going to work on being more wholehearted and I'm going to spend more time practicing vulnerability and being courageous around things that make me uncomfortable. And it's going to take several years to do it. But here's the scarcity secret. Like, don't tell anybody. But you don't get to say, and my life will start when I'm done. Here's my project, and I'll be worthy of love and belonging when I accomplish that. I'll be able to rest when I'm done. I'll feel successful when I'm done. It's the process that is so important. And I think one of the reasons we don't play and rest is because we're waiting. I mean, let me ask you, horrible scenario, Armageddon, right now in an hour, how many of you will say, I played and rested enough? You know, in the end, it's the old cliche, which are always true because that's why they become cliches. No one lays in their deathbed and says, I should have worked more. Nobody. You know, and I think so one of the powers I think that happens around midlife as well as the challenges is that we start to get the capability of playing the movie to the end. So when someone says to you, hey, do you want to do this? And it sounds really great and it kind of tugs at your worthiness of your productivity. But you think and you play that movie to the end and, oh, okay, so I can take that on and it's going to feel awesome for a week when I tell everybody that I took the promotion. And I'm going to like, how am I going to say it? And I'm going to drop it casually or like, yeah, I'm VP now. Hey, it's going to be awesome. Okay. And then let's check in 6 weeks from now. New desk. Awesome. 6 months. Divorce. Not so awesome. Yeah. 2 years. Both kids in rehab. Divorce still. Moving up the ladder. You know, we can play the tape to the end about what it means for our time. So I think in order to cultivate rest and play, we've got to let go of exhaustion as a status symbol. And it is unquestionably. How many of you would agree that it's a status symbol in the world that you live in? Let me tell you one way I collected this data. Oh God, it made me so car sick. I'm very motion sick sensitive. And I rode up and down in an elevator for about 3 hours in downtown Houston, where all the law firms are housed. Just over listening in the mornings to conversations that sounded like this. What's up, dude? Nothing. What's up, brother? Nothing. What time did you go home last night? 1 a.m. What about you? Haven't left yet. It was this bragging. It was this complete competition. In my, and I'm not, you know, I'm not a high-priced lawyer, but in my circle of friends, if I walked up to a group of my friends in the PTO after drop-off, and they said, hey, how's it going, Brene? And I said, oh, my God, it's good. I mean, it's really good. I'm really well rested, doing Pilates. I'm doing some great work, but I don't have more than I can really handle. Things are pretty great. It would not be safe for me to turn around and walk away. I would have to back all the way back to my car. They would be like, you are a loser. You are not doing enough. You are not enough. You are not being enough. You are not contributing enough. Because being busy is being important. I put this on Facebook this morning because I really thought about this. It's from The Gifts of Imperfection. That somehow we've convinced ourselves if we stay busy enough, we can stay right ahead of the truth in our lives. You know, so we just stay really busy so that truth never really catches up. And then when it hits us, the truth is we're exhausted. Resentful, tired, and not doing enough of what we want to be doing. You know, and it's hard to let go of productivity as self-worth because in this culture, if you and I are sitting next to each other and playing, or I meet you, hi, I'm Brene. Kathy. Hi, Kathy. What do you do?
I'm a therapist.
First question out of my mouth.
What do you do?
What do you do? I need to rank you in how important this conversation is going to be. But we do that because our leading question is, what do you do? Which is code for how important are you to me? And do I need to know you? I swore I'm going to make a pact that when I start traveling next season, when the book comes out, when Daring Greatly comes out, I'm going to start sitting next to people and saying, so what do you love? which will cut all conversation in business class. No, but I don't even have to worry about that. To be honest with you, I have this so down to a complete science. Because you don't like to talk to people that much. Except when I think I'm dying on a plane. But so all I have to do is like when they say, especially if I'm like in the business with the business people, and they'll say, so what do you do? That's always, they even say that before they introduce themselves. They'll say, what do you do? And I'll say, I'm a shame researcher. And they usually look right down at their iPad and go, these angry birds are fantastic. That's it. Done. It is, we laugh about it, but it is very difficult in our culture where we define each other by what we do. And we rank each other's importance by that. And I mean, how many of you in here are choosing to be at home with kids and raise kids right now? So it's very hard because we live in a culture clearly where what we do is who we are, at least in our minds. And I think we have the power to shift that. And I have to tell you that when you travel internationally, you do not see this. It's very rare to be in other countries and have somebody ask you what you do. They'll say, where are you from? Who are you with? You know, where are you going? They'll ask a lot of different questions before they get to what do you do. And it's something I think we should think about. Let's move to the next guidepost, which is guidepost numero ocho. Cultivating calm and stillness and letting go of anxiety is a lifestyle. Calm is a superpower. You're not going to believe it. I'm nouveau calm is what I call myself. I have learned to be calm over the years of doing this work. And letting go of anxiety as a lifestyle, I think it goes back to the briar patch. Let me see if I can explain this difference to you. It's huge, but it's nuanced. When I interviewed people about numbing, and you had people who really struggled with it, and then you had people who have really somehow learned to understand the difference between numbing and pleasure and comfort in their lives, here's what was interesting. I cannot separate, in my data, in my research, I cannot separate numbing and anxiety. When I talk to, and let me tell you something about wholehearted men and women, just so, you know, we have a better handle on who they are. Very few of these people, again, were raised that way. Most of them fought and scrapped their way to be wholehearted. And what they would tell me is, oh yeah, I used to numb all the time, now I do this. It's not like these people just said, I've never numbed, I don't understand that behavior, I seek comfort and pleasure, you know, no. And I don't even want advice from people like that, honestly. Because they can't tell, how do I know to get from here to there if you've never even been there, right? These are people that said, no, I've worked on it and this is what I do. And that's why I was able to get some very prescriptive information, I think, from them. What was interesting is that when a lot of the wholehearted men and women really recognize numbing as a problem, their fix was to reduce anxiety. To reduce what was driving the need to numb. When you talk to the other group about numbing, their goal is to figure out a way to keep living how they're living and not numb. It was very much about Diana and the briar patch. If you feel like a turtle without a shell in the briar patch, I'm not going to give you another shell to replace food, drinking, work. I'm just going to ask you to examine why you're living in a briar patch. And who that's serving. And so when we talk about anxiety as a lifestyle, I think a lot of us have set up lives where we live in a briar patch. And don't get me wrong, I mean, thorns are going to come whether we invite them or not. There are going to be hard things, but I'm not talking about letting go of anxiety as an experience. I'm saying letting it go as a lifestyle. How do we get out of the briar patch? I showed you earlier Harriet Lerner's book, The Dance of Connection. And a lot of this work is in her book. Here's what's very interesting about anxiety. Anxiety is not a function of individuals. It is a function of groups. Why? Because anxiety is the most contagious affect we experience. That means if I'm living in the briar patch, I'm bringing that briar patch into my home. How many of you have ever been in a situation at work where things are tense, but everyone's doing okay. And then one person comes into the team and is so anxious that it brings the whole team down. Because anxiety is incredibly contagious. So the way that most, and this is, comes a lot from Bowen Family Systems, in systems theory, the way we think about anxiety is it is a function of groups. It cannot exist in individuals alone for very long. It may manifest itself differently in different folks. I mean, when I'm really anxious at home and then Steve gets anxious, my kids don't act the way we're acting, but they do act out in other ways. They're more tearful. They're more sensitive. They get their feelings hurt. They bicker more because they're really sensitive barometers to what's happening with parents. All children are. And so what's interesting about anxiety as a function of systems is that they have found in research that we have one of two patterned ways of managing anxiety, all of us. And that divides up into overfunctioners and underfunctioners. So there are a group of us who in an anxious system, in an anxious situation, we overfunction. We, and this is where if you're with someone you love or care about, it's not nice to elbow them and call them out. And when I talk about this, let me tell you, when I talk about this in large corporations, I really have to tell people to be very careful. Because they're like, oh my God, that's John. You know, whereas John's their boss sitting right behind. Overfunctioners have a tendency in anxiety to become controlling, to know what's best for everyone else, to micromanage, to get in everybody's business and know what's best for people, but not look at their own stuff. Underfunctioners in anxious systems have a tendency to become less competent the more anxious the system becomes. These are folks who do not show up on time. They don't get stuff done. You can't count on them for very much. They can often in families become, you know, the subject of, you know, talk. What's wrong with Susie? Why isn't she doing her part? Again, they become less competent under stress and anxiety. So how many of you think that you are an overfunctioner in anxiety? Okay. And how many of you underfunction? Okay. So one of the things that's interesting, let me see. So it's about half and half, and it's usually about half and half. How many of you who overfunction are firstborns? Okay. Right. So about 70% of the overfunctioners are firstborns. Or are first girls. There we go. There's the other half of the overfunctioners, right? Birth order really plays a role in this. And I used to always think birth order was true because I'm the oldest of four. I live birth order. I know it. But we have more and more persuasive data around birth order theory and the role of birth order. And it's different. And there are different family dynamics that can shift things. But certainly, I think birth order plays a role in how we handle ourselves and how we handle anxiety. I mean, when you're told your entire life, like, Brené, make sure you close that kitchen drawer or your brother and sisters will be dead. Then you grow up with a pretty profound sense of importance, you know, that you have control over things that you probably don't have control over. And if you grow up conversely, girls, don't worry about it. Your sister will get it. You're raised to believe that you can't handle things. The story that I tell about over and under functioning. So we all read Harriet Lerner's book together. I think my mom sent that one out. She's very subtle. when she thinks we need to do some growth, in a certain area. And so we all read it. And it's very helpful to read these kind of books together. And because again, we go back to the issue of language, to share language, even if you don't agree. And so we read this book together, and so this is how it played out. My mom has a serious health trauma, like her heart stops. And it stops when she's sitting in her car in my sister's driveway. And so the next thing I know, we're at the hospital, and you know, and she's 68, this happens a couple years ago, super healthy, no health history, it just stops. And we get to the hospital, and Ashley and Barrett, my sisters, are there. My brother lives in San Francisco. He's not there. David, my stepdad, is there. My mom's back in CICU, and my husband is there. And I can tell from my husband's face that things are bad. because he understands at a different level what's happening than what we do. Because the numbers, like the numbers, oh, her heart rate was down to this. They don't mean anything to me. So we're all kind of panicked, and she's back there in CICU. And then the doctor comes out. And so, we're all kind of sitting down, and everyone's on my nerves. And I'm just not talking to anybody, and Ashley and Barrett are talking to each other, and David's kind of pacing and talking to Steve, and I'm just freaked out. So the doctor comes out, so I jump up and run across the room, and I'm like, Dr. Brené Brown, what's happening with my mother? Which is like the dumbest thing. Yeah, don't shrink, don't puff up. Like, and like, that's a terrible thing to do, because then what if he starts, it's like when all you can say is, hola, ¿cómo estás? Don't say that. And expect, because then if somebody comes back with the answer to how are you, you're like, oh no, all right, that was it, hola, so I say, like, hello, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. And David, my mom's husband, is kind of like, yeah, what's going on? Like, I'm over here. And so he starts telling me, and I'm like, okay. So she's going to be here for a couple of days. She needs pajamas. He needs to see all of her meds because she wasn't at home when it happened, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm like, okay, all right, here's what we need to do. Ashley, I need you to go and get mom some pajamas. They need to button up and down, all cotton. She gets really hot. Barrett, I need you to go to mom's house. I need you to get a Ziploc bag. Get all of her medicines, even vitamins, everything. We don't know what's counterindicated. It's really important you get everything. Ziploc bag. You know what? Let me go to the house and get the meds. I think it's really important that they have all the meds. You know what? You call Jason and let him know what's going on with mom. I'm going to get the meds, and I'm going to stop and get the pajamas because your mom gets hot. She gets uncomfortable. You know what? I'm sorry. Let me call Jason because this is a very sensitive conversation. He's far away. That's difficult. And all of a sudden, you see Ashley and Barrett doing this. And they get, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, that's freaking perfect. Of course, the girls are having a hard time. I'll handle it, of course. But they don't do that. I said, where are y'all going? Brené? That's what they're doing. Brené? Yes. You're over-functioning. And I was like, what? You're over-functioning. And I literally fell to my knees crying. I mean, I literally just fell apart because it's easier for me to do than it is to feel. And how we take on those roles of over and under functioning. It's easier for them to not show up than to feel. It's easier for them to be taken care of than to step in and fully become vulnerable and engage in this process that may or may not go well. And so I'm crying. They pick me up. I have to apologize to David. I have to tell the doctor, I'm a social worker. And this is my mom's husband. And I'm sorry. You still have to tell him everything because he should hear it. And I don't know what the you're talking about. And my husband's like, oh, God. Okay. And this really great doctor who actually, he's just been awesome. But so Ashley and Vera picking me up. I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm just scared. I don't know. They're like, we're scared too. But we are really good too, and we can help too. And we want to be doing something too. And I was like, okay. And they're like, we'll do more and you feel more. I'm like, that sucks. It totally sucks. And they're like, I know, but we can do this. I was like, okay. And it was still, he's like, I'm going to call Jason. I'm like, what are you going to say? And Ashley's like, anything I want. I was like, okay. Okay. But I think the thing about anxiety and the way we handle it and over and under functioning that's really important to remember is that those are shame triggers for us. If someone said to me, you are bossy, controlling, know-it-all, that would hurt my feelings. But if someone said to me, you're over functioning, that's fair. And it's true. And the people who love me have permission to tell me that. If someone called my sisters irresponsible, lazy, incompetent, not dependable, it'd be devastating to them. And I don't even like using it as an example because it's the furthest thing from the truth in my experience. But if they said, hey, you're under functioning, you have a lot to bring to this table. I need you to show up. That's different, right? And so one of the things that we have to understand about anxiety is our behavior in anxiety, are patterned ways of managing behavior that we learn growing up. And what I tell leaders all the time is that if you're a leader, you should know exactly how you function in anxiety, and you should have one or two people in your senior leadership group who have the balls to tell you. Everyone should have someone that they are close to that is willing to look at them and say, you're over-functioning or you're under-functioning. Because I think a definition of anxiety is that when you're in it, you don't see what you're doing, right? You're responding. It's a small crisis on the crisis continuum. So letting go of anxiety as a lifestyle is first and foremost about understanding who you are in anxiety. And I think it's kind of helpful to know how you got there. You know, Ashley and Barrett are 38, my sisters. We still call them the girls. And so I think it's really worth looking at who you are, how you got there, and who has permission to tell you in a way that's not shaming, in a way that's just, hey, you're over-functioning. And the people who tell me, the people who have permission to tell me in my work life, I have one doctoral student who can tell me, and my sisters, are people who are willing to have vulnerable conversations with me about who they are too. Does that make sense? So first step is who we are. Second step is about cultivating calm and stillness. So one of the things I learned in the research is that calm people share things in common. And they share actionable strategies in common. I think there are probably some temperaments that lend themselves to calm more than others. But calm is a practice, and here's what it includes. Calm people breathe. And I don't mean just like the rest of us breathe. I mean they are obnoxious breathers. They breathe. And they are comfortable in silence. So, for example, one thing that sparks anxiety more than anything else is like workplace gossip, right? I can always tell about the health of the culture of an organization by how much gossiping is happening. So someone runs up to you and you're the calm person and says, oh my God, did you hear? They're shutting down that entire unit next month. They're laying off everybody in the unit. Here's what calm people do. Breathe. The 1 minute they breathe, it feels like an hour to me, but just that, it's very likely that person goes, well, I don't know exactly what's happening, but what if that happened? Wouldn't that be a nightmare? So they breathe. The second thing they do is they always come back to anxiety provoking information with questions. It's amazing. I mean, this was like, I saw it in the first couple of people who were really calm. Then I saw it in the next 10 people and then in the following 100 people. Do y'all know people who can just walk into a room and bring calm and perspective without even sometimes saying a word? Yeah, my husband's built like that for sure, which serves him well in his work and being married to me. So they ask questions. So, okay, so tell me more about what is happening down with that unit. No, they're gonna close it down. They're gonna announce it on Monday and they're laying off all 30 people that work in that unit. Wow. So where did you hear this? I heard it down the hall. Down what hall? Down the hall that goes to the executive offices. You heard it from one of the executives in the executive office? No, I heard it down that hall. I'm sorry. I'm not clear on from whom did you hear it? No, they were saying that. Okay. Who's they? Okay. I don't know that's going to happen, but wouldn't that be horrible if that happened? I mean, that's the thing that, you know, calm is about not buying in. And then the last thing that they do is just an incredible question. And that is, there's two questions actually. One big question and a follow-up question. Number three. Okay. First you breathe, then you ask questions. Number three. Do I have enough data to freak out? Which is an incredibly helpful question. And if the answer is, I heard it from John. He's the president of human resources. He called me into his office. They're not going to announce it until Friday, and they're only going to tell a few of us. Then it's going to happen on Monday at 8 o'clock. There's 30 people. They've already put together the packages.